Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of umoja, embrace with love.
That's right. We are doing it right. And I can't say that we are not doing it right because I am in Chicago at the Nova Black Repo Summit. And this is a space where some kick-ass black women are here. And so I had to break away for a minute so I could do the show. And this is the reproductive rights. It's like bringing together, this is probably for the first time, you know, women are doing work around reproductive health, whether they're doulas, midwives, providers, storytellers, healers. This space is all here. So we had a powerful opening this morning, and I'm always glad to connect these struggles with you in St. Louis, but women are doing the do. I just can't have to say that. But we're here. This is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield. And this is a time when I remind you that things are not right in this country. We still have a pathological liar and, war criminal in the White House. He is surrounded by like-minded folks, including P.P. Hespick, who is on this, what do they call it, an excursion into Iran, but it's costing us not only the lives of people on both sides, but billions of dollars a day of our tax dollars. That's causing a international financial crisis, so you feel that at the pump when you go fill up that tank. So this stuff is all related, and there's things both home, domestically and nationally that we have to be on top of. I mean, this war is really, really, really wreaking havoc on the rest of the world, really. But people of color, and particularly black folks in this country, of course, are going to have it super bad because that's the way it works under racial capitalism. But, there's been some positive things since we last saw each other. Myself and Percy Green were able to host a group of young people from Marquette University on their civil rights tour. They came through Ferguson. That was hosted by the Urban League's Ferguson Empowerment Center. And so anytime young people are interested in history, I'm like, yes, 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 yes. Like, got to make some space for them, got to make some time for them so we can pass that knowledge on. So that went very well. They were going south, going to hit Montgomery and some of those other powerful places where civil rights history still resides. But also over the weekend, we had the remembrance of the tornado, I call it Tornado Louie, that came through here a year ago. And, residents on the north side are still suffering. A lot of those places look like May 17th. In other words, not a whole hell of a lot has happened, and we got to change that. So St. Louis, woke people are in the process of, first of all, demanding more money for the north side for recovery and rebuilding. And sometimes it means getting from other pots of money. So there's also been a real struggle to stop the police budget, which is going like $25 million over what they need. But they also are demanding some of that RAM settlement money, which is in the millions. And what the woke people are saying is, this is a good example of equity versus equality. We don't need to spread the money around equally. There are some sectors that need it more than others. And we're saying the majority of that money in of the RAM settlement, not all, but the majority needs to go to the north side. Just recently, in fact, today, Jamila Nasheed put out a statement. And for those of you who don't know Jamila Nasheed, she is a former senator, former state rep, a former committee person. So she's well entrenched in what she knows about city politics. She's also been a resident of the redistrict ward of 12. And she sent a letter to Alderwoman Tyus asking that some of the Black grant money in her, under her purview, be shared with those residents, again, tornado recovery victims. She's sitting on $3 million. That's not her money. That is money that, taxpayers' money that's supposed to go towards improvement in that ward. So Ward 12 residents, if you didn't know that, now you do, and you need to be asking Alderwoman Tyus to loosen up that money for some real serious needs right now. So, yeah. The other thing that happened, y'all, and I'm just quickly losing faith in the criminal justice system, the court system, just because most of it is under the control of the MAGA monsters, is that an appeals court upheld the judge's ruling that Chris Dunn is going to remain free. And those of you all don't remember Christopher Dunn, he was freed probably 4, 5, 6 years ago, I can't remember now, because he was wrongfully convicted, served too many years in prison. And that was, that judge said, okay, that's it, he's free, that's enough. And here comes the state attorney general saying, no, we think we want to challenge that. And lucky for Chris and his family, the appellate judge upheld that ruling. And so I talked to Christopher and Kira, his wife, yesterday, and they were cautiously optimistic because they like, the AG is the AG, so we don't know when they're going to come back at us. But for now, that was an important ruling for Christopher Dunn. So this is two things that's happening this month, and you all know I got a thing about the months, but this is, May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and that is, we should be doing that every day, because this country is making us sick and unhealthy mentally, and so we need to pay attention to that. But it's also a month for awareness around missing and murdered women, particularly Indigenous women. And so that is, in fact, our topic for today. And so I want to introduce our two guests. One of them probably is not a stranger to you, and that is Theda Wilson, who is the mother of Christian Ferguson and the founder of Looking for an Angel. Welcome to the show, Theda.
Greetings and thank you. It's a pleasure to be in your presence and to be on your platform.
Thank you. Thank you. I feel mutually the same about you coming on. We also have Alicia McCulley, who is a civic fellow at Washington University. And Alicia had an interest in this particular area. And so it's just important that our young people take up the struggle, take up the research, take up whatever they need to do to help inform and empower some of these issues that we have. So welcome, Alicia.
Thank you. And I'm happy to be here to talk more about the project.
Okay. So I just want to say there's some stats out there that are dismal, frightening, ugly. And I want to start, first of all, with the fact that there are 1,000 unsolved homicides in St. Louis. Now, that's not just women. That's across the board. In fact, many of them are males. But I have to say that because I think it points to a system that uses race and class as a way to approach these missing and murdered people, and particularly women. And so 1,000 unsolved homicides, y'all, that's a lot. And last year I had some of the mothers of those missing children, as well as a representative from St. Louis Public Radio, who did a 2-year study on why this was happening. And so before long, I'm gonna tell you what their conclusions were, because I think it has a lot to do with why we have so many missing folks. But according to the National Crime Information Center, you know, there are about 280,000 women and girls that were missing in 2022. And 36% of them were Black, when we only represent 14% of the population. And so that's disturbing, y'all. That is truly disturbing. We've had a few laws that have been attempted to be introduced, and I know Theda is on top of that. And so we're going to talk a bit about that. But the fact that we have this, in fact, growing numbers of missing and murdered folks, because first of all, they may be missing and you don't even know what happened to them, if they're alive or not. And so there's a distinction between missing and murder. But the stats are not good, y'all. They are not good for people of color, particularly Black women. So I'm going to start with you, Theda, to talk a little bit about how you your entree into this ugly mess with the missing and ultimately disappearance of your son, Christian. And I have to tell the listener, honest, the reason I was drawn to this case is because it happened in the neighborhood where I do most of my organizing over there in the old 22nd Ward, really just a stone throws. And when I heard what had happened, I was suspicious immediately. I'm like, that doesn't quite sound like what would happen on that particular block. But also, Christian's birthday is the day before mine. And so I said, I'm going to always remember that baby's birthday and think about where he is from day this day to that. And so every time it came around October 11th, I'm thinking, okay, Christian would be this age right now. And then on top of that, I said, until this baby is found, we're going to continue to keep the missing poster on our bulletin board at the Rowan Community Center. And we did. And I think at one point, Theda came through. You see, you still got that poster up? Yes. And when he was finally some closure to that, we took it down, but it stayed up there for literally decades. So talk about Christian and talk about looking for an angel.
All right. Well, first, I would like to just thank you for all the knowledge that you've shared already, because I think you can tell my story. Matter of fact, I know you can tell my story. And there's just a lot of people out there that can tell my story. But I think you, with the makeup that you are and being the legend that you are and your support system, that you could do a great job at telling my story. But I am the mother of missing, murdered Christian Taylor Ferguson. His birthday is October 9th, 1993. And he went missing on Wednesday, June 11th, 2003. And in the beginning, I just automatically start saying that the father staged, S-T-A-G-E-D, my son's disappearance. And a lot of people around me didn't understand why I was using that term. Some people that I collaborated with on trying to increase awareness of my son's disappearance, they even challenged me on some of those collaborations because I was using the word staged, because they felt like that's an alleged situation there, right? But I knew from the get-go. And I mean, I went to
high school. Mothers know these things.
And then there was just some insights that I knew just from, you know, living with the father, knowing the mentality and going through a lot of struggles that I'm writing about at this time, and that I'm even doing documentaries about. So I would like for people to understand that this situation started as a custody battle. And it's imperative that people understand that, because if you don't get the beginning right, you really won't understand a lot of the other things that come up. And a lot of children, even parents, they die because of custody battles. Some people have even taken their own lives and the lives of their children because of custody situations. So in my situation, Judge Thomas J. Frawley was the division judge in Division 15, 22nd Jurisdiction, St. Louis City. And it started off actually in Judge Quigley's court, but it was moved to Judge Frawley's courtroom because the father contested an alleged divorce. So I'll say alleged there, because I was not married to him. And a lot of people are confused because the media kept running with it, saying that I was married to him. And you'll learn more about that as I write and as my story is shared. But the father staged my son's disappearance on that Wednesday, June 11, 2003. And I believe Deanne Lane did my first interview. It's like I could still just see her standing in my face at 1200 Market Street in front of the old police department. And, it's looking back is something that I hate doing, but I love doing at the same time, because I love history. And I believe that we should learn from the history that we live. We're all part of history. It's like, what part are you going to play in history? And I'm doing my best to navigate this circumstance in my life so that I could be a light to others. And I could be the lion or the lamb. And a lot of people know that. But anyway, it's been a challenge just trying to get people to understand why I'm in this position. And that's one thing I really want people to understand. Sometimes you don't look to be in certain situations, but you are kind of drafted into tragedies. And it gets back to how are you going to navigate those circumstances. The father's family had a big construction company, Pyramid Construction Company. And there's a lot that I could say about that, but I didn't have those, the affluence that they had. And because of that, I suffered greatly and lost a child. Actually, I feel like I lost my family. I feel like I lost parts of me. I know I did, really, because the life that I'm living is not the life I expected, even though I know we shouldn't have. Well, I do. I guess you can have expectations, but just know that they may not go the way you expect them to go. But it was hard for me to go through the custody situation and have notified the system that abuse and neglect was involved, and even notifying doctors. Everyone in positions of power who could have saved the life of my child could have done so, but they failed miserably. And to be able to go through a trial and see the same individuals, some of the same individuals, because some of the people that were on my side or who could have advocated for me, you know, when the trial time came, I was told they're deceased. And I didn't really even know that I was fighting as long as I was, because it seems like maybe a month ago. I won't say yesterday, but maybe a month ago. And I'm still, you know, going through pictures, going through documents. I live with them. And if anybody's Googled my story, they know that, like Kristen Hinman was telling in the Riverfront Times article, I had all these boxes in my car. I just moved to North County, back to North County, and I have boxes right around me right now because I'm still living through these boxes. And eventually I'll put something on a wall. I feel like I'm at a place where I can do that now, especially after having some form of justice. And I say some form because I've received something that most seek, but it's still not just, you know, it's still just us, just us. And I feel like the struggle will continue until God comes back, something like that, because we were born into a struggle, and because of our race, we'll always be fighting for what we deserve, what they don't want us to have. And I'm not saying that all people of other races don't want us to have this. And even some of our own people, sometimes we work against ourselves, but it's just a spiritual battle that we're in. And either you're going to do what's in our best interest or you're not. Some people are afraid. They know the right thing to do and they just won't. But when you don't do the right thing, I wind up putting people like me in positions that I'm in. Because if I had a rightful judge, a just judge, you know, because people vote for these judges. They vote for, you know, the people that run the system. And that's one thing that I even pushed through looking for an angel. I want people to make sure that they know who their state representatives, their senators, or on all levels, who is your council person? Who's your alder person? You know, are you attending these meetings? And if you can't, are you aware of what's going on? Do they have sites on the government site or city, county, or nationally where you can, you know, zoom in and tune in and make change come? That's one of my hashtags I use a lot, make change come, because it's imperative that we do so. But
Kristen had a genetic life-threatening situation. So it was imperative that they start looking for him right away, because time was ticking in terms of him not getting medication. And I think about all the time when people say my child is missing, yes, and black children, that is, black women, whoever, and folks drag their feet. And when I say folks, I mean the system drags its feet. And particularly for a child, did you feel like they moved quickly when they found out it was a child that had a life-threatening medical condition that he needed to be found very quickly in order to get that medication? Or did they say, well, we'll see what happens. How do you know he was, like, you know, kid, you know, hijacked and all of that? Did you get lots of excuses at that point?
Actually, because of the way my case went, I would say that they jumped right on it, because my mother that morning, she was hearing about this child missing while I was at work, and I had no knowledge because I'm not as savvy on this smartphone. I don't even know if they had smartphones at that time. But I just remember her saying she was going about her breakfast and my father, I think he was tending to the yard or something. But all of a sudden she realized this is her grandchild. And when you look at the time, I want to say the police report was saying like 6:09, between 6:09 and a certain time, that the father alleged that he was kidnapped, carjacked. And so by the time she was hearing it, I think that it flowed well. But the problem is that some of the things that I've seen the system do after my son went in a coma that his father called trying to kill him, and after the disappearance that took place before a watching world, you know, it was then that we got the attention that we needed, but they could have saved the life of my child. I was writing the media, Sally, Jesse, Raphael. I was writing Oprah. My mother brought that to my attention at the documentary that you were present for. Mm-hmm. So there were so many things that could have been done to keep the disappearance from happening. But by the time the disappearance happened, I believe that the system moved very well and in a way that it does not often, almost never, moves for other Black people especially.
And so I know that publicly you talked about being thrust in this, and a lot of Black mothers have been. I mean, you're minding your own business, trying to, you know, struggle through life, and all of a sudden this thing hits you where now you have to become savvy on the court system. You have to be savvy on the social service system, and all of this is new. So you're learning as you go, but meanwhile, time is ticking. And so you've been through that system, by all the court system and trying to do that, including up until when your Christian's father was prosecuted. So I just really want to talk about the fact that I know from the organizations that I've worked with that is not an easy place. And there's many mothers and fathers and grannies that say, I can't do it. I'm going to let the Lord take care of it. I just don't have the strength. I don't have the resources. And it won't bring it back anyway. And so for those people like yourself who say, I got to keep moving. I got to keep pushing. I got to get justice for not just my son, but it gets amplified. So it's really going to help many other mothers, either through inspiring them to like step forward or just helping them to figure out what they need to do for their own situation. So what has been the thing that kept you going? I know it was your son, but what was some of the, there might be more than one thing that really just said, I got to keep pushing.
Man, I almost start crying when you really, really, because you can't tell my story. You know, the activism, and you know, so people like you, Malcolm, Martin, they my yin and my yang, but people like you, people like Percy Green, you know, I grew up with wonderful educators that made sure we knew about Mary McLeod Bethune and other people. Even my mom, she was like, this, get out the Ebony Black Encyclopedia. So I was birthed in a situation in a family where we knew that it was imperative that we knew who we are and where we come from and about the struggle that continues forever. Right. But when you said the clock was ticking, it really made me, it's like tears just kind of came to the front of my eyes, because that's really just exactly how I felt. Because I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to be a psychologist. I wanted to be a lawyer then. Well, first I wanted to be a firefighter, but I know we don't have enough time to go back to the age of 5, because that was the first job I ever wanted to do. But I'm afraid of heights, so that wasn't going to work. But, you know, I love law. I love the Lord. I love law. And I had to learn about the Missouri statutes, getting the Black's Law Dictionary and going downtown, going in the archives, learning how to use technology, things that I was clueless. I mean, I went to the Academy of Mathematics and Science with Applied Technology and Junior ROTC, so I was highly intelligent. But when you're talking about the fact that you have the clock ticking while you're trying to save a life, and it's your child in a system that don't care about you because of your race and your social economic status, and they don't care who your mama was or your dad or the influence, which those things did help me, you know. But I'm just saying, I still didn't have Oh my God. It's so much to say, and that's why I have to write and tell the story.
I know. But some of that is being put into a documentary, so exactly. That helps. But exactly. I'm going to bring Alicia in, because I think amplifying this, I know that there's a lot of attention when there's a white female or a white child, and this is why people have been pushing back and organizations have emerged to identify like the lack of attention. Alicia, what made you interested in this particular topic?
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to say this is something that I feel like is not really widely talked about, even, you know, just on a national level. As you were saying, media tends to focus primarily on wealthy white women that go missing. And so I was looking kind of at the intersection. I was saying, okay, so not only do you have a higher risk because you're a woman, like, you know, a lot of these tend to be caused by femicides, but also you have a higher risk because you're Black. So I'm looking at the intersection between how these cases are handled in the Black community and how the rates tend to be higher. And so I really wanted to kind of push out like the message of what was happening, and also kind of minimize the distance between people who have experienced a family member go missing, and also the access to the resources that may be able to help them. And so my project is sort of a mixture of informational campaign as well as digitizing these resources. And so in doing that, I'm focusing primarily on North St. Louis and North County. I am from North County. And so, you know, seeing, you know, hearing the stories, Theda's story, and similar stories that have happened in this area, I really wanted to prioritize an issue that I think gets overlooked way too much.
So I'm thinking with that kind of project, what have been some of the preliminary conclusions that you've drawn based on the research and the interviews with, you know, victims and their families? What are some of the trends that you're looking at right now?
Mm-hmm. So one common one that I hear about a lot is the categorization, especially of young Black girls or young Black children really in general, as runaways. I think that has kind of put a halt in the process for a lot of families in the process of looking for their loved one. I also think that a lot of this is not new, but it's kind of derived from, I like to call them pervasive narratives. So narratives about Black women, such as, you know, they're seen as less innocent, less vulnerable, and are expected to be at a higher risk versus a white woman. And so a lot of times that affects how the police tend to be more stagnant when it comes to Black families. Mm-hmm. And so in doing so, I also have heard a lot about how these biases can appear even in people that are receiving the media. So, you know, a lot of the times the language that outlets use matters. You know, we see that, you know, big media campaigns can also lead to big social media campaigns, which then mobilizes, you know, you can get even the FBI involved in some of these cases if they get enough attention. And so I think kind of the overlap of these has made almost a cyclical kind of effect, to where the lack of information leads to lack of response, and then it just keeps going and going.
So you mentioned that whole thing about the runaway, and that's definitely one of the things that I see, and I'm not even doing the research. It's just like you see it every time there's a missing person. Well, she's probably a runaway. Don't let it be a Black teenager. And, you know, that was the case with Shamika Cozy, who was 16 back in 2008 when she came up missing. And this child had never run away. She'd never been missing. And that's what they told her mother. Oh, she's probably a runaway. Well, you know your child. No, she's not a runaway. But what I have concluded, and that's from looking at the system, but also following some of these cases, is that that's the easy way out, because if it's a runaway, you don't have to do an alert, you don't have to do any paperwork, you can wait that 24 hours, sometimes 48, and by that time, whatever's happened is like down the road. But for our teens to be listed as a runaway when there's no evidence of that, and you know your child, and the only reason you would be reporting them is because it's real, it's serious. And these people say, let's wait a while, you know, she'll come back or he'll come back. And you know your child is like, no, something has happened to my baby and I want to do it. The thing that follows that, Alicia, is then because they are inactive, you as the mother have to then start it. And so you'll mm-hmm. see parents and supporters doing the, you know, missing. They're the ones that's creating the leaflets and posting them. They're trying to talk to people to see when was she seen last, or he was. They're doing the legwork that we're paying police to do and to do. And so that puts such a toll, I think, on the family, because you can't even grieve. And I've heard many, many parents say, I couldn't even grieve my child because I had to start looking for them, or I had to start, you know, getting justice for them because they were murdered. I know parents who actually told the police who murdered their child mm-hmm. 10, 15, 20 years ago. That person's grown, whatever. And so it's just such an injustice to our community. And I'm just thinking, when you are looking at the statistics and the practices of police departments, are there going to be some recommendations about how our community could help? Because you never know when you'll be in that situation as a granny, you know, big mama, whatever. And so is that going to lead to some recommendations for these departments, these agencies, to be better suited and better acclimated to being serious when Black children are missing?
I really hope so. My primary focus in terms of interacting with law enforcement is to demand that they take these cases seriously. I'm especially thinking about, you know, when a family comes to you, you need to have a quick response. There cannot be a delay. Additionally, I also aim to get them to not immediately classify them as a runaway, but also to look at the full totality of the circumstances and actually pay attention to what the families are telling you, because a lot of the times there's information to be gleaned from that. And so I'm hoping to essentially make a statement. I'm hoping to compile these thoughts as well as input from the community itself, actually, and bring that to law enforcement. Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and we are here with Theda Wilson, founder of, you know, Looking for an Angel, and that first angel was her own son, Christian Ferguson, but helping mothers look for their angel. And Alicia McCulley is here. She's a student at WashU that's very interested in this subject and doing what she can as a young person to bring some light and some action on this. So you made me think about legislatively what we have can do. And we know we've been having the Amber Alert for years. And it just seems almost counterintuitive that we have to have an Ebony Alert.
Correct.
I mean, it's not a child a child, and if they're missing, you're going to immediately get that out to people. But no, that's not the case. And so I know there's been efforts by Senator Moses to introduce that. And for a couple of years now, and I know something happened, but I want to tell people about the Purple Alert, mm-hmm. if you don't know about that, because RJ's law, which passed almost immediately, you know, House and Senate, boom, 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 bam, is around alerts for children with disabilities. Again, I'm thinking a child is a child. Why come they all can't be? So what tends to happen when there's sectors that need, vulnerable sectors that need special attention, that means that the authorities are going to get some training about what happens if they're disabled. And I'm thinking Theda, Christian would have fell into that category as having some disabilities, and probably mm-hmm. they moved on him quick. But for others, the Purple Alert may not be sufficient.
Exactly.
And so now we got Amber Alert, Purple Alert. Where are we with the Ebony Alert, which is going to be about the Black kids? Do you know if that passed and if the governor's going to sign that?
Well, we're hoping that the governor will sign that. I'll have to check with Senator Mosley or go into the file, because I'm surprised that I'm still here on this live with no issue because my cell phone is not allowing me to pull up anything concerning some of the things. Well, I knew about the Purple Alert and I was able to finally get that page, but I have to get confirmation on the passage of that. But I'm glad you brought this up because Christian had a metabolic disorder called citrullinemia, meaning that he was unable to break down proteins. And so even when I was trying to get the CTF passed through Senator Angela Walton Mosley and Shamim Clark Hubbard, she was doing some things here locally on a local level to try to get an alert, the CTF alert. Because Christian, if he has to have his medication within a 24-hour period and his special diet, he's going to die. You know, it's just some hours. He's going to die. So just because you put that alert out there, and I don't even think just the alerts, period, are sufficient, but it helps to bring about a knowledge of the urgency of different situations. Because I wanted with the CTF alert for everybody, the hospitals, doctors, lawyers, everybody who's responsible to initiating something in their positions to do so. But, you know, whatever her race was, I know what she was, but she was like, isn't the Amber Alert sufficient? She didn't say sufficient, but that's what she was saying. Mm-hmm. And I said, no. And the reason being is, especially for Black people, because they're never going to, they haven't anyway, responded the way they're supposed to for Black people, period, the proper way. So, for most cases, even though they did okay in my case, but most of them, they don't. Yeah. But they give you too much discretion. They give law enforcement too much discretion. And that's the reason why I want the CTF alert, because law enforcement under the Amber Alert, they can say, we don't think that it's Amber Alert worthy. So there's no discussion about this if a child is missing. Yeah. Just go ahead and do what you need to do.
Yeah. And in Christian's case, he not only had that congenital problem, nonverbal, and so he would not even be able to talk about help me, I'm feeling really bad. Correct. So to me, he should have got almost immediate attention, Amber or otherwise, because we don't even know if the Ebony Alert will ever pass, particularly under the Republican legislature that we have, because it was introduced last year and they said, so what, you know, I say they don't care, because that should have been just like the Purple Alert, RJ's Law, that should have been whizzed by, or strengthen the Amber Alert. So to that woman's, you know, remark, I think that's a logical thing. Well, doesn't the Amber Alert cover you? Mm-hmm. Hell no, because my child is Black and I'm Pope. That's why it doesn't cover me. But, you know, the training still goes to, the bias that a person who has to make that decision, because there's criteria that has to be used on the Amber Alert. So somebody, some human, is making the determination whether or not this is going to be an Amber, a RJ, a Purple Alert, or whatever. Therein lies the problem, because most of these departments are going to be white-led. And so and they already have a view about Black parents, Black working-class parents, Black children. They've criminalized us in a way that, you know, is going to take, you know, decades for us to undo. But we have to fight for the dignity of our children, the safety of our children, because that's all who's going to do it. And so I'm thinking about, Alicia, have you seen some successes in other places where they put the kind of amplify the voices of mothers, they put the spotlight on this that's worked, that's healthy, and it's working?
Well, the first example that came to mind, actually, I want to shout out Senator Mosley. I heard about the Missing and Murdered African-American Women and Girls Task Force. And I think Minnesota had a similar task force, and they've actually been able to do correct and proper research into this issue, particularly among Black women, and also have been able to make a dedicated department that specifically focuses on these cases. And so, like you were saying, I hope those are the first steps towards equity, but I really do believe that in order to properly address the issue, you need to expand your current systems, and you need to make reforms to actually get it to the place to where everybody gets the proper attention. And it shouldn't have to just be, we need to make a new thing specific just for us.
Yeah, and I have a growing concern about the fact that we have an international trafficking system and have to wonder what happens to our girls. What happens to the cute little kids that come up missing and they're never to be found? And I always say, okay, somebody grabbed them for that that trafficking, sex trafficking stuff. But, you know, I think if we don't try to put some brakes on this, then those people who are predators are saying, hey, I can get away with this because they're not even going to look for them. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely happened to the indigenous women. They've been dealing with this for like decades, for generations, that those girls come up missing and nobody even looks for them. So that's what I keep thinking about. If we don't get a handle around this, get our hands around this, our girls and the boys too are just going to be potential victims of sex trafficking. Do you see any evidence of that, Alicia, in your research?
Yes. I know specifically there is an overlap between socioeconomic class and human trafficking. And obviously socioeconomic class is heavily tied to race, right? And so I would be curious to see if anybody has done a study on how that specifically is related. But also, I know that by targeting these people, they know already that if I target somebody that has less wealth or somebody that, you know, is a person of color, there's a lesser chance that I will get found out or that there'll be a proper investigation. So I think we're already seeing, you know, the effects of having a lack of policy around.
And I know there's been some established groups like the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children. And certainly they've helped sometimes because they have resources, including the aging technology. When these kids have been missing for a while, they can do that and then put out another poster. I'm wondering, Theda, what has been your relationship with groups like that in terms of getting support and help? And do you find them having a lens of race and class, or are they pretty much like anytime a child is in, that's their main thing, a child, they don't care what?
Well, there have been many challenges because I remember walking down the halls of the city hall, you know, before I received this form of justice for Christian. And I was fighting with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children because they kept saying non-family abduction. And I was having the same challenge that a lot of people are having with them labeling our children as runaways. Because I'm like, wait a minute. First of all, I knew who killed my son. But for them to say non-family, I'm like, that's his biological father. What you mean? But
no, that ran away. He couldn't walk. He couldn't talk.
Right. They weren't saying that he ran away, but they had it listed as non-family abduction. And as we have found out, the father.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, wait a minute, I know what happened, but politics comes into play, and I must give it up for, I mean, I know that we're focused, you know, a lot of people, I'm just saying, I got to give a shout out to some of the white people that helped me along the way, because everybody that's white, not bad, and some of them will speak for us when some of us won't, and sometimes, like I said, we work against ourselves, and even on a legislative level, because in one particular situation that I could talk to you off camera, which I'm not afraid to really say, but I just want to kind of lay that foundation. You'd probably come out better on your side anyway, because you like, and plus I'm in a governmental position and I don't want to make it look like, so it's the reason why I'm saying this.
Okay.
Because it was a black person that knocked a bill that I was assisting with from passing. So, and then I just thank God that got allowed for the bills that are currently out here, like Senator Mosley's bill, to even be in existence in this climate and culture, you know, that we live in. So we need to really count those blessings, because to have a legislator, the membership to look the way it is and even be here talking about whether it's going to pass, that's a miracle in itself. But it's just, the National Center, also known as NCMEC, National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. I was fighting that for a long, long time. Then that wasn't removed from my son's flyer until they decided to stop saying it.
Oh, wow.
So it wasn't like my big mouth wasn't enough. So I do have a problem. I'll write about that too. But I'm grateful for some of the things that they've said, because it's just like I'm saying, am I not a man and a brother? You know what I'm saying? You know, it's like, am I not a woman and a sister? You know, it reminded me of that, because it just reminded me of slavery. Like, can we be free? Can we be, get some attention to? Can, you know, and you got to fight through these same systems. And a lot of people see me as the Black female John Walsh of St. Louis, or probably the country, but because that's what, you know, people are like, you like John Walsh, okay, yeah. And I remember playing in the closet at River Rose Mall when I was a kid and getting in trouble because my mama didn't know where I was. And then when I heard about Adam Walsh going missing, it changed my life.
Yeah,
you know, because I didn't really know it was happening until I watched the news and I saw, oh my gosh, this can happen.
Yeah, and it's kind of sad, Theta, that our children can't play in the yard or be in the park. Because I can think about times when, you know, our moms was in the house, you know, cooking or whatever at work.
Yes.
And we were out and about, you know, innocent, you know, not thinking about somebody's watching us, you know, plotting on us. We, you know, but the society has changed so drastically. Yes. And for children to be that restricted that they can't even feel safe in their neighborhoods because, or in their schools because somebody watched them, I think it's just a tragedy for us. And so when you're advocating, I think one of the things when I'm advocating for a situation like this, I you know, people always say, oh, I feel sorry for it, Theta, I'm so glad, blah, blah, blah. And I'm glad it didn't happen to me and my kid. But that's a mentality that we got to get out of. And so I always challenge people to think, if your child was missing, what system would you want in place? What would you want it to look like? How responsive would you want it to be? And start thinking about that, because all of us are just a step away from our child being missing or murdered in this kind of society that we are in. We are just a step away from misery or wrongful incarceration, from losing a home, from being disabled. So think about the systems that are in place now and how they should be responsive and looking like they're going to really pay attention to our needs. Mm-hmm. And so for children, it seems like it would be easier because these babies can't talk for themselves. They are relying on people like us to be their advocates, even when they're missing and even when they've been murdered. We still are their voice. And so what suggestions do you have for our broader community? And I'm going to ask you this too, Alicia, to how can we be more responsive?
Well, we can be more responsive by being intentional about everything that we do. You know, you know who your representatives, like I said, are. Go to your meetings, send a representative if you can. If you hold 2, 3, 4 jobs, then maybe your neighbor can go for you. You know, build positive relationships. Make sure that you're doing everything in your power to do what's in your best interest, and learn what you can do, of course, like I say, in your capacities to address the missing persons epidemic. But that could be learn what you can do in your capacities to address any situation. So you just always want to choose good. Like when I was suicidal going through all this, you know, like the custody battle in the beginning, because really that's what I'm talking about. Because I didn't know how to live with this man taking my children from me. And I felt guilty because I birthed these kids in a world. They didn't ask for this. I didn't know this man in high school that I met would do this, you know, but still I had to learn how to fight for my life so I could fight for others. You know, especially my children. And still to this day, through the government, through every capacity that I find myself, I'm trying to do what's in the best interest of others. So I feel like if other people would think that same way, not just what you can do for yourself and keep your, if it's happening next door, you're just a couple of feet away. It's a chance it's going to happen to you. Mm-hmm. And kids talk. And when your kids go to school, they communicate with other kids, and then stuff will filter. And I work for the school district. I'm just saying, I've seen a lot of things. I went to school, you know, even though my little kids were like, you old, you what? You know, you older than my mama. But I'm just saying, and I'm just 54, but my little preschoolers, they were like, what? You old? My mama 25.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Yeah. But, you know, you just really have to do
my big mama.
Yeah, right. But you have to do what's in your best interest. You know, think ahead of the game. You know, don't just think about the temporal. You know, even though in faith, God will provide for this day, but still make your plans and he'll direct your steps. If you're Christian and you go by the word, okay, he will provide for the day. But he also said, or it also is written, that you make your plans and he'll direct your steps. So if you're thinking for in the right way, make sure that those steps are purposeful and that you're doing what's just and what's proper. And also, don't be afraid to stand up against injustice, because a lot of people, oh, if I say something about that, then they might come after me. And mm-hmm. And see, that's one reason why I don't have a problem with going hard for, especially at this point, because I'm like, I ain't dead yet. Shoot, come on, let's do what's going on over here.
Come on with it.
What I got to lose? I lost my baby. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. What I used to wake up like, dang, I'm still hurt, you know. But God moved me to a position. Okay, yes, you're here for my good purpose. So what are you going to do to make it a wonderful day for somebody else? You know, and I had to learn through my tragedy to accept that love from the students that I served when I was of sound mind. Y'all, I don't want y'all thinking I was like, finna go crazy in the classroom.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
Oh, my babies. Yeah. But they helped me to get where I am. And they taught me things from their level that I applied in a
moment. Their needs were, yeah.
You know, so yes.
So Alicia, what are you expecting folks to how to respond to your project, and what are you going to be asking the community to do? I know one of the things you're going to do is to consolidate resources that'll be available, but what action will you be asking people to take?
Well, I think the very first thing you can do, I'm going to create a website, and I would ask, please, if you're able to submit any thoughts, concerns, questions you have through that website, because at the end of my project in August, I'm holding a town hall, and I would like to have a panel of speakers and experts on these issues, community leaders, to answer these questions, to discuss these concerns, and ultimately to create a statement, sort of compile all of this information and present it to whoever I can, whether that's law enforcement, policymakers. And then also on a broader scale, you know, community support is kind of, you know, one of the major ways that you can respond to the missing persons epidemic. And so I would just ask people to support your neighbors, support each other.
Very good.
And I think key to this is going to be making our communities safe and secure, starting with the children. We want it to be safe for everybody, but the most vulnerable and the most innocent are our children. And if we can't send them out to play in their own yard, because sometimes these kids are snatched out of their own yards, then we got a greater responsibility that has not been met. And so it is up to us as responsible adults to take care of our children, to make them feel safe, and to for them to actually be safe, whether it's in school, at the playground, and in the home.
Say one thing too, because I like what you're saying, but what I was just thinking about was also how the families need to hold other family members accountable too, because like my son was going through all that abuse and neglect within his father's home, and you know, there should have been something done from that. You know, I remember when I found out somebody I knew lived down the street, and they wound up telling my friend when they found out it was my child, my mother said, they were grown, but they were like, my mother said that they never saw but one child. They were talking about my survivor child. But if you know there's two children in that home and you only seeing one child all the time, then wait a minute.
Yeah.
You know, to me, everybody is a mandated reporter. So stop leaving it up for social services, because so many kids die because social service won't do their job.
And now so it's like a guilty person feeling like I should have, could have, would have said something, but had I known. Yeah. Exactly. I always say it doesn't hurt to ask.
That's right. And then the church.
Don't have to accuse. Just ask the question. I haven't seen Christian in a while. Is he okay? Is he sick? I mean, again, folks feel like if I ask, then they're gonna think I'm accusing them. No, just be considerate. Be mindful that you know something is happening.
And these pastors need to get on some stuff too, because I mean, I understand praying, but can't you? God said, "Faith without works is dead." Now, I'm just saying.
Yeah, and
where your works.
Even if
it's on a pastor.
Yeah. And in fact, pastors could make it a project within their congregation. Exactly. Let's do this around missing and murdered children.
That's right.
One thing that you can do, because exactly. They got an active audience. Why not make it an issue for your church, your social justice committee, or your social justice ministry to really amplify this? And maybe that's something, Alicia, we could do, because we want people that are already organized for whatever reason
that's
to
right.
be involved, whether they be sororities, frats, churches, clubs, whatever, that you're going to take this up and do something, even if it's just being aware and passing out some literature or having that conversation in your home or at your church or in your workplace. But I'm like you, Alicia, we're not talking about this enough. And we may talk about it when we hear something about a Christian. Oh, isn't that too bad? So sad. But what can we do to prevent another Christian from having that and another family from going through that grief? So, you know, it's still much to be done, and you all will be hearing more about that. There's lots of things that are going on. I just want to say that we're still in the budget process. We want people to go to the website for the city alderman, because there's hearings. We need you to be there, understand what's going on. But we are totally opposed to the police department getting any amount of Rams money, but you have to let all the people know that. We know now that the Cabinet branch and the Julia Davis branch libraries are now open. They were, you know, under renovation because of the storm, Tornado Louie. And it comes at a good time, because we just got the national reading scores, and they're pitiful for our children. Of the 83% of the schools that were data was collected, you know, those things are dramatically down. The reading scores are down. The math scores are down. We got a lot of work to do with our children, but get them to that library, get them in and start reading to them and have them read to you. City Hall, there's going to be a virtual and in-person hearing on Wednesday the 27th. In fact, today they had one at, they're going to have one today at the International Institute at 6 p.m. On Arsenal. So they're trying to get input from citizens. So don't say somebody else is going to speak for you. As many people, they need to hear from a lot of people, y'all. Next week, we're going to have Sal Valadez, who's going to be talking about the reductions of Medicaid under, you know, the big ugly bill and under the MAGA monsters. Now, Medicaid is all some people have in terms of health care and health insurance. And if that's getting cut, then we're going to have some more fatalities. And so you don't want to miss that. If you miss any of the programs, any of them, you can always go to JamalaRogers.com, and you will see that there is both the video and the audio.
Africans at home and throughout the diaspora.
Do your thing, pass it along, and share.
Unity
and
is
so much, y'all, that we don't know. But I definitely want us to be supportive of folks like Theta and, you know, other parents that are going through this. I don't know what happened to the music, but we're going to take that to be... it might be that I don't have my headphones on, but we're going to leave that one alone. But thank you, Theta, and thank you, Alicia, for sharing today. And this is not the end. You know, we are going to continue. And whenever you get that town hall, Alicia, let us know so we can make sure people support that. So this is Jamala Rogers, your host, and I will see you on the battlefield. Thank you for listening.
Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
We need more UNITY.
Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now's the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja.
Embrace with love.